Welcome to Post Carbon Radio. I'm your co-host, Karin Nyhus, with Bing Gong. On Post Carbon, we cover a broad range of climate problems and solutions, including bad news, good news, and different perspectives on what constitutes solutions to climate change. On today's show, we will bring you two guests. First, Dave Ransom, labor journalist, will update us on prosperity in the economy of abundance. What is it? Is it happening? And how is it actually playing out here in Northern California? On the second half, we'll be joined by energy writer Leah Parks, co-author of All Electric America, to update us on green energy technologies and what it will take to bring them to scale in the USA. And thank you for joining us here on Post Carbon Radio. Before we bring on our guests, who we're very excited to be talking with today, we just have a quick update from Standing Rock. There's been a lot going on, and if you didn't already see this, the head of the Standing Rock tribe, David Archambault, was just in Geneva last week, and he presented a formal invite to the UN Special Rapporteur for Indigenous Rights in Geneva, inviting her to come and see what's going on there and weigh in on the situation. And thanks to you, Bing, I got to actually talk with her yesterday morning.
Yeah, we didn't even know where she was. She travels the world.
Yeah. So her name is Vicky Tolley-Corpus. And you know her from the International Forum on Globalization, right?
Correct. She's a fellow board member.
Okay. And now she has this special rapporteur status. And basically what she told me was, I said, are you coming? Are you going to go to Standing Rock? And her answer was, well, if we're invited. So the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. Went through the process, put a letter into the Obama administration saying, we'd like you to send in a letter of invitation to Ms. Tolley-Corpus, and then she can come officially and give a report to the UN on the situation for human rights of indigenous people in Standing Rock. And Vicky told me that also other special rapporteurs on the environment, water, toxic waste, and human rights were also interested in coming. So it's possible that there could be a big UN presence in Standing Rock in not too long. So that was exciting to hear. Okay. Well, now we're very happy to bring on our first guest, Dave Ransom. Dave Ransom is a retired journalist with roots in the underground press of the 1960s and in the major trade union publications of the service employees and the carpenters unions in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. He currently lives in Santa Rosa, where he reports weekly news for bilingual radio station KBBF, 89.1 FM. And in the interest of full disclosure, I write on that news team, which is how I know him. Welcome, Dave.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So just tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and your background. You're a journalist and labor activist, right?
Yes, I was a graduate student in English at Stanford when the movement of the 60s began, and I ended up dropping out of graduate school, starting an underground paper with friends, and that led into journalism very accidentally, but very providentially, in Washington, D.C., for both the service employees and the carpenters unions, which were great learning arenas for me. And when I retired, I came out here again and have been involved in alternative press and media since I arrived about 4 years ago.
How many? 4 years ago?
Yep.
Okay, that was my next question. So we're going to leap right into the subject of today's interview. What is technological unemployment, or is that the term you'd use, and how did you get interested in it?
Well, since I've been in the labor movement and before, I've been very interested in the situation with jobs. And also, of course, having been around Stanford, where the Silicon Valley, when Silicon Valley was getting a startup, that whole thing. And more and more, you see in the regular press nowadays that robots are taking over the jobs. So I got very interested in that. I come from a science background family. And so I'm following the science, and it's clear that this is sort of an unstoppable force, and we need to understand it.
What do you think is most important about robots and, I guess, also software replacing human beings? What do you think most people don't know?
Well, the good news is that that we're entering in a period of abundance for less and less human labor and potentially no human labor, and more efficient production. On the spot production, which doesn't require transport, so that we cut out all the gas emissions, there's enough for everybody, more than enough for everybody, without our having to put in the basic 8 hours that they work. The bad news is that the system isn't set up for that. Our system is set up so that you have to work to get paid to buy the products of your labor, and so that we have to change the system of distribution to recognize the new order of technology. This is the biggest change in human society since the agricultural revolution, maybe since we began making tools. It is a tsunami. It's not taking a couple hundred years to develop like even the Industrial Revolution. It's taking decades at most. People are by and large unprepared for it. I noticed in your music that led into the show, the fellow was talking about dealing with things before it gets out of hand. Mm. We're on the cusp of that getting out of hand at this point.
Yeah, and just to remind listeners, that's Bing's grandson who created that song, so we're very proud of that. Well, let's bring it down local. You've been talking about the real big picture trend. What is going on with technological unemployment in Sonoma County specifically? Can you give us some examples of technological unemployment in the North Bay or the Bay Area as a whole, and what kinds of work are being displaced?
Well, the best entry to that story is Amazon. Amazon has three huge, absolutely huge, 16 football fields, huge distribution centers in the Central Valley. At the same time, Macy's is shutting 100 stores, not in the Bay Area, but nationally. Sears and Kmart are shutting stores. The Gap and Sports Authority have already shut in Sonoma Valley. And the reason for that is that Amazon e-commerce going on the web is getting the sales, and so the old form of big box stores that's been around since my grandfather's day is going out the window. That people are pretty much understand that, but the rest of that story is that not only are the people who work in the big box stores losing their jobs, but Amazon bought the robot company that makes the little robots that go around the floor picking up stuff and bringing it to the order person, and has done away with their warehouse staff. Now, I worked in the warehouse at one time, and it's sad to see that go. I mean, it's a tough job, but it's a job. So they have, at the last count, I think they have something like 30,000 robots doing this work. And working three shifts, that's 90,000 jobs, plus the ones that they're doing away with in the big box stores. Now, that's an entry to understanding the kind of upset that you can have in this area. There were articles in the Press Democrat last week about the expansion of warehousing in Sonoma, Napa, and particularly Solano counties. And this is warehousing for the wine industry and for other such things as other food elements. And those, you know, if you're putting in a new warehouse, you're not going to put it in with planning for the kind of workers that you used in the 1970s. You're going to put it in for robotic warehousing. So this is a short-term jobs for construction and long-term job loss. They're just a couple of examples. I have more if you'd like. Wine industry, restaurants, so on and so forth.
Dave, now, these workers that are losing their jobs, how are they responding?
Well, that's a good question. The warehousing that's being done away with, and it's not just Amazon. There were stories last week about a broad number of warehouses that are converting. And the Teamsters Union represents some of those warehouse workers. And they're doing their best to maintain the jobs, but they're not going to be able to do it. And the effect on them is to, they have to come in with saying, we'll accept losses of pay, we'll accept losses of benefits, and they'll just keep the jobs. Just the same as what was happening in the auto industry as it was robotizing. And so they really have a very... They don't have an organized voice except through trade unions, which were set up for dealing with the past situation. My guess is that people are. I know I have one friend who worked at Macy's who's saw the handwriting on the wall, got out and tried to find another job. Found another job in small scale retail, and those folks are having hard times too. So now she's scrambling to look for work and really is having a hard time maintaining her house. This is part of the whole thing that people are seeing now, where folks are losing their jobs or taking big cuts of pay, having hard times maintaining paying the landlord, paying as much as 50% or more in this county, and maybe moving to the Central Valley to see what they can manage there.
So that sounds pretty grim. It sounds like there's this new situation happening pretty fast, and that the traditional means of responding to it, like the unions, are set up for a different paradigm, and they're really only in a position to give concessions as long as they can to keep jobs that are shrinking in pay and number.
That's absolutely the case.
Yeah. So go ahead. Oh, I was just going to scrape the bottom of the barrel and ask you if there's any upside or you know, what are the jobs that are created when the new technologies emerge? For example, design, production, and maintenance of the robots, computers, developing the software. What do you know about that in terms of Sonoma County or the North Bay or Bay Area generally? Are there new jobs emerging?
Well, of course, particularly in Marin, there is a growing biomed industry where they're coming up with biomedical breakthroughs that are essentially part of the same technological development. And so, yes, there are developments there, and they're pulling in folks who have got the kind of postgraduate degrees to make that work. Just as in the, I mean, Silicon Valley has got jobs to spare, and they're faced at this point with a needs for to move to expand. I mean, they've sort of taken up all of the land in Silicon Valley, and so they're moving it, as we know, into San Francisco and probably up here. But those are highly skilled, highly educated, and highly paid professionals. But that's not really doesn't help the folks that are getting flushed out by the robotics.
Right. So if you're just joining us, this is Post Carbon Radio on KWMR. I'm your co-host, Kara Nyhus, along with Bing Gong. And we're talking with labor journalist Dave Ransom, who's talking to us about technological unemployment in the Bay Area and beyond, with a focus on the North Bay. So it's interesting that you mentioned biomed, because I know there are artificial intelligence systems coming down the line in the medical field that some people say might replace a lot of doctors' and nurses' jobs.
Oh, that's very much the case. There are stories, you know, coming out of the local hospitals saying that their way of bettering their services, but also cutting their labor costs, is to automate to the extent that they can. And yes, there's automation of surgery, and there's definite automation of skilled nursing. There's automation of practically the whole of the wine industry, for that matter. So you can run, but you can't hide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I just misspoke. I think that would be categorized more as an expert system than artificial intelligence. But anyway, so maybe this is an obvious question, but how does this shift in the kinds of work that are available affect the labor market and income and wealth?
If we understand this thoroughly, has a change of such a fundamental character that nobody in recent history has had to deal with it, then we need to understand that if you can lower the labor costs to the cost of a machine in any part of the world of capitalism, capital will move there because at least for a beginning, they can make a higher profit. And that forces labor everywhere in the system down to that level, particularly when you have when people think that the only way I'm going to survive this is to get as much education as possible, and you get a whole bunch of highly educated people coming in the labor market. It doesn't mean that education doesn't mean that they're going to all get the jobs or that they're going to get jobs that are high paying. So the rapid development of robotics in our area and elsewhere pulls the labor wages down generally. When the state passed the $15 minimum wage, the McDonald's said, "Hey, you know, this just means that we're going to bring computerize our automate our production." When the farm workers got their overtime after 10 hours a day, after 8 hours a day, recently that the governor finally signed the bill, the small farmers said, "Well, not small farmers, the big wine." Vineyards and wineries said, "Well, we're going to robotize our production. This means we will stop harvesting by hand. We'll harvest by machine. They already have machines for that. This means we'll stop pruning by hand. We'll start pruning by machine. There are robots on the market for that." So it's something, like I say, you can run, but you can't hide. People are going to have to run because they're going to have mouths to feed. But the point, the real necessity is for us to organize so that the majority of folks, the 99%, can change the system of distribution. Can change the fundamental economic, the politics of the economics, so that we all get the product of 2 million years of human development.
Well, I want to go back to Henry Ford. You know, he had the vision to see that if he didn't pay his workers enough wages, no one was going to buy his car. But I'm afraid in this modern economy, the corporations don't see it that way.
I don't think it's a question of not seeing it that way. Because, you know, what you're saying is the easiest way to understand how this is the capitalist economy shooting itself in the foot is that if you automate your production and nobody's getting paid, there's nobody there to buy your goods. On the other hand, if everybody else is automating, you have to do that to keep up. Capitalism doesn't have a international organization to police itself. That's us, in effect. And we have to understand that now we have to take control of the economy. That's a political step. We have to take control of the economy because we can't leave it up to the 1% who aren't organized and don't have any interest in doing this.
Dave, I'm going to throw out a couple solutions. We're moving quickly because we never have enough time. But the couple things that I've heard out there that are of interest to me, and I want your reaction. One is the universal basic income, which was an idea from Milton Friedman, actually, from the late 70s, that instead of having welfare and social programs, everyone should get a certain amount of income just as entitlement for citizenship or maybe residence, if you want to think about people who are undocumented or not citizens. Anyway, so universal basic income, and some people in the climate world would like to tie that to a like tax and dividend carbon tax, where you pay a carbon tax on your consumption. And so if you want to fly around the world every week, you'll have to pay for it. But whatever taxes are collected from the carbon tax are redistributed on a per capita basis. And in my mind, that could be very closely tied. That could be the source of funds for a universal basic income. So that's number one. And then the second one, we'll take them in turn, would be co-ops. Because that's not just about distribution, but it's also about the decisions made at the point of production and democracy in the workplace, as Richard Wolff calls it. So let's take them one at a time in whatever order you feel like.
Well, the income idea is very important. That is what we're talking about in terms of a new system of distribution. If we run the country like we run a family, everybody would get what they need depending on what's available, and everybody would put in what they need to put in or are able to put in. And so this is really, I mean, it is a socialist idea, but it is also the way you run your family. And then the question is, well, how do you organize to make that work? And yes, neighborhood organizations, co-ops, whatever, that are actual groups pulled together around a purpose that represent the 99% and not the 1% of owners. Are absolutely necessary. We have a neighborhood association here that's talking about having a thing on the homeless recently. Well, the homelessness is an outcome of the pushing out of the economy of great numbers of people. At least a good part of the homeless are simply there because they're either not getting paid enough or there aren't jobs. And this is a sort of the tip of the iceberg. Well, our neighborhood association is going to have to start thinking about how do we operate given the cause of the homelessness. How are we going to operate in the robotic period? If that answers that, that deals with at least two of those points you made.
Well, it also makes me wonder about what you mentioned at the top, which was trade unions. Are trade unions still an effective response? Are they organized in a way that's effective? You know, I was listening to Richard Wolff, and he said, yeah, trade unions lately have been reduced to, and historically, a lot of them in the United States have made concessions, and that's been part of their deal. But the reason he promotes worker co-ops is that he says, you know, managers aren't so much the problem as the owners. And this makes the distinction between managers and owners and says we can manage ourselves. We don't need managers, and we need to, you know, take the ownership back to ourselves. So just wondered what you think about that and, you know, whether there's still a role for traditional trade unions or whether trade unions need a revolution in what they do and how they do it.
Okay. I want to answer that part, but first I want to say something about Alvarado Street Bakery in Petaluma, which is I think it's in its second generation of workers. It's that old and very effective and productive group, and they do very well self-organized and self-directed. Mondragon in Spain is the best example internationally. They have they're in their third generation, and they're you know, they have everything from food stores and banks and a university, and they manufacture their own stuff.
And they've got something like 100,000 people, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's 100,000 workers, so mm-hmm. times 2.5 for the family, right? But one of their major productions is washing machines, dishwashers, and the like, and that industry is now being robotized in China. So they're up against competition that they can't compete on the basis of labor input. And so this is also true of trade unions. Every institution in society today is being under mind by this technological economic revolution. You have to understand that it's a technological revolution, and it's causing an economic revolution, and that is causing a social revolution. So that so that everything is being pulled two ways, being pulled backwards and being pulled forwards. And the trade unions have been responding to that to a certain extent by moving into representing the lowest paid workers, the home care workers, the household workers, the fast food workers. When that happens in this county, I mean, the Living Wage Coalition and the North Bay
Organizing Project. You're talking about Sonoma County.
That's not that. It's the other one. Jobs with Justice have been talking about living wage, but when we discuss it, and it, you know, they'll pull 25 groups together. When we discuss it, we understand to a certain extent that this is an organizing step towards dealing with the jobless future. People understand this is coming. How do we organize from our position in labor that they're saying to get a voice at the table when we need it?
Well, that's
and all different groups need to be thinking in this term.
That's a big question, and I'm going to use it. Unfortunately, I have to cut you off, Dave, because we're at the bottom of the hour, and we're going to, in a moment, bring on our next guest, and we're hoping you can stay on the phone with us.
Okay,
because we're going to talk about another technological revolution in the energy field. And before we jump into the next segment, I just have two quick announcements for listeners. One is following up on the Standing Rock report that Indian leaders, Native American leaders, are in Washington the next couple days meeting with the White House about future ways, better ways to consult with Native American nations in things like the pipeline construction. And also on the subject we were just discussing, Ralph Nader's group is doing a sort of two-day confab in D.C. right now called Breaking Through Power. And that's going to be covered on The Real News and other places, but they were just on the air talking about co-ops. So I want people to encourage listeners to tune into that. All right.
Well, let's bring in Leah Parks to talk about the upsides of a green energy future. Leah Parks is an associate editor for electricitypolicy.com and Electricity Daily, a journal and daily newsletter that examine current events and the state of electricity industry for utility executives, commissioners, regulators, and other experts in the field. She is also a freelance writer, has acted as an advisor for Technology Reports, and has written extensively about innovations in energy storage, smart grid technology, energy infrastructure, and renewable energy. And she, along with David Freeman, have just written a book called All Electric America, A Climate Solution and the Hopeful Future. Welcome to Post-Carbon Radio, Leah.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Let's start off with, how did you and Dave Freeman meet, and what brought you and David to write this book, All Electric America, together?
Dave Freeman and I, before I start, I want to mention Dave Freeman was one of the speakers at Ralph Nader's Breaking Through Power event.
Great.
And I think he just spoke this morning, or this afternoon. It's on the East Coast, so it was a morning for us. But yeah, just wanted to mention that. But Dave and I met at an energy storage conference, and we realized, even though we have a good 40 years or more of difference in experience, he's 90 years old. He acted as the utility CEO for over 40 years for public power, like Tennessee Valley Authority, Los Angeles District of Water and Power, and a few others. We realized that we had a shared vision for where the energy infrastructure needed to go, not just for electricity, for our current electricity use, but for all of our needs, for our heating and our transportation, and also to power our industrial needs. And we got talking there that people were misinformed about how this technology is available now to we have renewable energy technologies are actually available now to power all of our needs. And we got to talk about it and decided that we needed to let people know that this was possible. And he said, do you want to write a book with me on this? And I said, let's do it. So we set out to do it 3 years ago.
Great. Well, one of the things many of our listeners know is that the coal market is collapsing. What are other important trends in green energy technology advancement and in the cost of renewables? What else is headed down and what's on the upswing?
Well, as Dave pointed out, we are having a technology revolution right now. I mean, there's a technological revolution happening. Solar technology prices are dropping, and wind is dropping. Battery prices are dropping, which is allowing our electric vehicle prices to drop as well. We have hydrogen. Hydrogen technology is there as well, and hydrogen fuel cells and so on. And then also our heat pump technology. We now have cold climate air source heat pumps, which was one of the reasons it used to be that the efficiency of our heat pumps would not be high enough to be cost effective in general at around 25 degrees Fahrenheit. And now we can get below zero with our heat pumps, and that's information people don't know. And so, for instance, with the solar technology, you can get new solar or wind for utility scale for about 3 cents per kilowatt hour now, 3.5 cents in Texas and places like Texas and California. And a few other places, and also in Dubai, in Chile, and there's another place that's going below 3 cents unsubsidized. And if you compare, and wind is at about 2.5 to 3 cents per kilowatt hour. That's the cheapest. Whereas our natural gas is about 7 to 6 to 14 cents per kilowatt hour for a new natural gas plant. Our coal is 9 to 14, and nuclear is way up there, above 10 cents per kilowatt hour. So what's happening is that solar and wind and batteries are all technologies, and these prices continue to drop, and we're having this digital revolution, and we've been having it, and we're having something called exponential growth technologies, where we're able to learn really fast and build on our technologies, and they're taking off exponentially. And so that means the prices are dropping, and most analysts are not, and certainly the folks in the energy field and in the international energy agencies and the different just big agencies that have been looking at this are not realizing how quickly these prices are dropping.
Well, kind of connecting this program with our first half hour, Dave was talking about unemployment in this new future of technology. What do you see as a potential for new jobs with going to renewable energy?
Well, I think that we need to invest in our electricity infrastructure. It's aging, and it has been aging dramatically. We have the situation where we need that the American Society of Civil Engineering gave our energy infrastructure a D+. So that's even beyond electricity. That's also our pipes. And they said that we need to invest about $3.6 trillion by the year 2020 to build this infrastructure. So for climate change reasons, we need to move to renewable energy. But also because of our aging infrastructure, we need to reinvest in this infrastructure in any case, because it is aging. Our coal plants are old, and we're obviously not going to be building coal anymore. But it's about 50% of the U.S. electricity generating capacity was built before 1980, and about 74% of all coal plants are 30 years old. So those are going to go anyway, and we're not going to want to rebuild them. And there's other things as well. So, I mean, the other generation as well, our nuclear and our natural gas and everything. So we need to rebuild this, and that will provide jobs if we rebuild our energy infrastructure. So if we do that with renewable energy instead of rebuilding that with fossil fuel infrastructure, then we do have the opportunity to create 40-year jobs in operations and in construction and in engineering as well.
If you're just joining us, that is the voice of Leah Parks, co-author with Dave Freeman of All Electric America, A Climate Solution and the Hopeful Future. This is Post Carbon Radio. I'm your co-host, Karin Nyhus, with Bing Gong.
Leah, why do we need to make this transformation that you say is inevitable happen by year 2050 and no later? I'm under the impression that we need to act right now or yesterday. What is your comment?
Well, the idea of saying 2050 or no later is the time by which we need to get to zero greenhouse gas emissions. And that means that between now and then, we need to average about a reduction of our fossil fuel infrastructure and our greenhouse gas emissions by about 3% per year until we get to zero. And there's a lot of folks that believe, in order to stay below the 2 degrees Celsius temperature rise that we agreed upon it at the Paris talks, if we want to stay below the 1.5 degrees Celsius temperature rise, we need to get to zero by about 2030. The year 2030, but what we need to do if we do the 2 degrees Celsius temperature rise is we need to do about 3% a year. But that's on average. There is some discussion that it would be good to do a really big push and reduce greenhouse gases faster. Some have said we need to really cut out our natural gas infrastructure quickly because it's such a potent short-term warming agent. So we can look at, and there are places like San Diego have decided to push to become, to have their electricity infrastructure be all renewable sooner than the year 2050. And so we can do that, but we just have to keep our eye on the ball that on average we're doing 3% per year by 2050. That's a way of kind of keeping it, realizing that this is not necessarily a huge strain on us. This is something that we can do. We have 35 years to do it.
I wanted to bring in Dave Ransom, who we had in our first half hour. Is there anything you'd like to weigh in on, Dave?
Well, I think that the coming technology is maybe coming faster than many of us know. And that even folks in the know are going to be surprised by. And really, the big problem is getting the political will to make the changes that are possible to make.
Leah, back to you on that. I know you write about that in your book. Do you want to say a few words on political will?
And we definitely do need the political will to do it. And that is what's holding us back, and also the fossil fuel industry. They have a lot of power and money put into this system, and they don't, like good capitalists, they don't want to give that up, you know. And as we've seen with the tobacco industry, sometimes it amounts to lies and misinformation that they spread to not give that up. So, you know, we are divided politically, and clean energy is being seen not as a huge opportunity for investment and jobs and growth, but as something green and something Democrats want, something left-wingers want. So that's unfortunate. But something that's interesting is that as this technology continues to drop in price in advance, I'm seeing more and more, even than before I started writing this book, that this transformation will happen. This transformation could happen to us even without the political will, you know, kind of despite ourselves. It could happen in the same way that Dave was saying, you can run, but you can't hide. Tony Seba, he's a lecturer at Stanford University, has said that by 2030, he believes we'll see the end of the internal combustion engine. He just thinks that the battery technology is evolving so fast and so quickly, and our EVs will evolve, EVs, electric vehicles, will evolve so quickly, and prices will plummet that we'll just start adopting them because they make sense, and there's nothing the fossil fuel industry can do about it.
There's an assumption of a we here, and I see how an us and them developing. That the we are going to be that them are going to be the folks that have the income to shift from their gas guzzler to the clean electric car, self-driven, as it were, and the rest of us are going to be still hanging on because we can't afford the money to come up with it. And it's in making that shift, perhaps, that is where the political will is necessary.
Yeah, this is Karin. I'm going to jump in because what that reminds me of, Dave, is the Cash for Clunkers program a few years back that the Obama administration in their first term offered people money. I think it was national. I don't think it was just in California. Yeah, it was national. But it was a short period of time, and you could get paid, I don't know, $1,000 or something to hand in your old gas-guzzling car in order to get those polluters off the road. So that's a kind of actually fairly low-level subsidy, right? It's not big dollars to do things like that. Leah, do you want to say anything more about that?
Well, I think that's the kind of thing that will happen, and our electric vehicles will end up being cheaper for us in any case as the price comes down because they'll be cheaper to operate. We won't have all of the different moving parts that the internal combustion engine has that we have to keep bringing to the service station. And so that will be cheaper, and we'll be able to charge at $1 per gallon. Now, of course, that also has its impact on a whole supply chain and all of the, and which goes back to what Dave is saying. It's going to change where the jobs are, too, and what types of jobs and different jobs that we'll find because we won't need as many of the dealerships to be managing and repairing our cars all the time. So we will see changes, but the prices will come down, I think, for the consumer in the end. And the Cash for Clunkers is something that can help promote and push it.
I'm remembering also, as we talk about jobs, how Van Jones was sort of emerging as a national champion just as Obama was coming into office in his first term, a national champion for green jobs. And that was really the vision, that in the course of doing what has to be done for the climate, that we will create a whole new suite of jobs and it could, you know, be jobs for communities that have either had no income or very low income or histories of unemployment. And it seems like he got squashed like a bug in Washington, and we don't talk about green jobs anymore.
Right. There's a movie, Catching the Sun, that came out by Shalini Kataya. She's the director. And Van Jones was in that, and Jigar Shah was in that as well. And Jigar wrote the book, Creating Climate Wealth, Unlocking the Impact Economy. And he talks about how entrepreneurs and investors can unlock massive potential that climate change represents. And he says that there's new technological innovation and deployment of existing technologies can happen. And he talks about that in Shalini Kataya's movie, and Van Jones is in there as well. And indeed, we are not realizing it. Some of it is the media isn't seeing it, and you'll see Jigar Shah, he tweets about it all the time, and he's written blogs and so on, talking about that this is not, we don't realize that. The media doesn't realize all of the jobs that could be created by this and the money that could be created by it. So in some sense, I think investing in our electricity industry and in our infrastructure in general could give us a really great buffer towards that robotic future we're going to have, because indeed we're not going to bring the manufacturing jobs we had. So when certain presidential candidates say, I'm going to bring a whole bunch of manufacturing jobs back to the U.S., you know, it's nonsense because those don't exist anymore. But definitely doing this is a great opportunity. And the U.S. is actually missing out because China and China is ahead in this. They, for instance, for wind, the U.S. has got the for manufacturing and deployment, we're the third largest company. Goldwind, the U.S. company. Goldwind is the Chinese. It's number one. Vestas is from Denmark, right? Is that correct? And then
yep.
U.S. is GE, and we're number three. But five out of the 10 top wind companies are Chinese, not from the U.S. So, you know, we think of ourselves as the leaders, but we really have the old 20th century infrastructure here, and we're not leading in the future technology, clean tech in many cases.
If you're just tuning in, this is KWMR. You're listening to Post Carbon Radio with Karin Nyhuson Bing Gong. And that was the voice of Leah Parks, co-author with Dave Freeman of All Electric America, A Climate Solution and the Hopeful Future. So we have about 8 more minutes in the show. I want to see if Bing, is there something you want to get in there?
I'd just like to point out in your book, you point out the obstacles, the thought that natural gas is a bridge and that we've got to keep it in the ground, and nuclear energy spares the cure. I'm so glad you put that in there, because when we heard about Diablo Canyon, our remaining nuclear plant in California, there was a lot of pushback by the pro-nuclear forces that we needed nuclear, but you point out that the cost is too high. So I'd just like to compliment you on putting those elements in. And then you also have a part three, the opportunities, something about hydrogen as a hope of future and heat pumps. Could you tell us a little bit about those two as possible futures?
Well, hydrogen is we can now, right now, produce hydrogen electrolytically with electricity. So if we build a renewable energy infrastructure, we could build extra wind and extra solar. And then with the extra, we have a buffer so that there's always enough energy, as well as with our storage too. But we can make hydrogen with the electricity that we produce from that, and the hydrogen can be used as storage. And we can also use that hydrogen. We can use hydrogen to power cars with fuel pumps. And we can also use it for airplanes or boats. And, for instance, right now NASA is developing electric airplanes. And and one of the engineers thinks that by 2030 we'll be using electric airplanes for short distances. But for longer, you could have hybrid hydrogen airplanes. So you can use that for that. You can also use the hydrogen in place of natural gas for industrial processes as well. And then they're also looking at hydrogen for we're also looking at other ways, the big we, our researchers, to produce it chemically with solar energy reactions, and then using some chemical as a catalyst to help split water and produce hydrogen. So there's a lot of potential there. We have the technology. We can use it now, actually. And there's ways of as we innovate, making it even cheaper and having greater amounts of it. And then heat pumps. Did you ask me about heat pumps as well?
Yes, I did.
So heat pumps are exciting because we would use those to heat our homes and for industrial needs as well. And you can use ground source heat pumps where you extract the heat from the earth or from the air, and then they're powered with electricity, and then it's our air conditioners running in reverse, basically, and also our refrigerators. So it's the same technology, and we have it, and we're improving on it. And those that can be used in Canada, they're being used in Alaska and in other Nordic places. So we can use it. We don't need to use natural gas heating at all. And it will be more efficient, and it's ultimately cheaper. The issue is the upfront cost and getting financing for everybody to be able to use it, and smart financing.
Which is back to Dave's point about equity, right, and access to get everyone converted and not just the people who can buy the latest and greatest technology, right?
Exactly. And there are so many ways of doing it. We could have our utility industry, which there's a Green Mountain Power is doing it now in Vermont, and they're actually doing it where they finance it. They help the consumers. They bring them the contractors. They do a home energy audit, and then they roll it all into their energy bill or their electricity bill, and they end up paying less each month or about the same. And then once it's paid off, the consumer pays less than they would have.
That's interesting, because it reminds me of GMAC becoming, General Motors becoming, a finance company more than a car company in the years before its crash. But this sounds like a more sustainable financing model. Would you say so?
I think it is. And I've heard a lot of reasons, you know, people tell me why, oh, it's so hard to get our big utilities to do that. And Dave says, nonsense, Dave Freeman, mm-hmm. The co-author. We did it, you know, at TVA, and it's a big company, and they actually have a heat pump program. There's no reason not to do it. But, again, it's getting the political will, and we have a lot of people inside of our energy and companies who have good intentions, but they're big dinosaurs. They're big bureaucratic dinosaurs, and they're slow boats to move, and they're not keeping up with the likes of Silicon Valley and Elon Musk and the such.
Alina, would you like to give a website so people can hear more about your ideas?
Sure. It's allelectricamerica.com is the website.
And what's coming up for you? I mean, you mentioned that Dave was just speaking this morning at Ralph Nader's Breaking Through Power. Anything else coming up major for you, too, in terms of promoting your work and your ideas?
Well, Dave, he just published another book. I think it's called The Green Cowboy. I don't have it right in front of me, and I've asked him for my copy. When's my signed copy coming, Dave? And he said, you have to come to D.C. to get it. So he just published that book. So he's 90 years old, and he published two books in 1 year. And he also was involved in the talks on Diablo Canyon with Friends of the Earth, and because he's a senior advisor there. So he's pretty amazing. And he hasn't told me what his next steps are. He says he has something in the works.
We need more vital elders like Dave Freeman.
Oh, my gosh. He's an inspiration. And he does exercise 2 days a week, so everybody, you know, take that in mind.
Right. I'd like to give Dave Ransom an opportunity to have some final words.
Well, I think the bottom line for me is that we need to get folks. I think that the reason that people aren't more aware of the great things that are happening with technology is that they're that the powers that be would just as soon not have them know that because they're afraid of losing their jobs to it. And I think that if we can come up with clear, understandable shift so that we go from the idea that you have to work to get what you need to live on to We're breaking through. We've accomplished what we set out as a human race. If now we just have to make sure that everybody understands that we can have enough and will have enough, and we have to set up our society for that, then we can love the technology and not fear it.
Well, with that very optimistic statement, I want to thank our guest, Dave Ransom, labor journalist from the North Bay, and Leah Parks, co-author of All Electric America. Thank you both so much for being on Post Carbon Radio.
Thanks for being on, Leah.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. It was really a great discussion, really important topic.
I'm trying to spread the word about this immense issue, but I find it absurd why so many people are confused. Some people don't understand the weight of this problem. Act now before it gets out of hand, cause Earth is calling. I was 10 years old, exposed to it. The inconvenient truth really made me concerned how it was going to affect the youth. The temp is still rising from the pollution we produce. We need to start striving for a solution to reduce. When we burn fossil fuels like coal and gasoline, we're using dirty energies when we should be using clean. When we burn, we're adding to the greenhouse effect. CO2, CH4, and N2O collect in our atmosphere. They remain up there for years and years, absorbing sun rays that come near. But we need to persevere, cause this makes our planet's temp rise fast. So why can't we find a way to cut back on our greenhouse gas?
We have waited too long. Act now before the moment's gone. The situation's tough, but stay strong until we see the dawn.
The climate's on my mind, the climate's on my mind. The climate's on my mind, the climate.